they had these things that they loved, particularly espionage, the idea of Englishness, corporate England. They absolutely loved taking the piss out of that whole new 80s generation of red brace wearing Thatcherite people. And I think they were ahead of their time in that.
Get a fax over to Clifford Harrington's, EGM 3 o'clock tomorrow. Find out where Janet is and pull Martin in. From where the hell is Martin?
I wake up.
Right, and get Sarah in here now. We've got an agenda to work up.
Pod. If this is your first time listening, this is probably the world's only podcast to have covered such diverse touchstones of popular culture as the Phantom Raspberry Blower, Ned's Atomic Dustbin, and Rent-A-Dick. My name is Tyler Adams, and on this show we look at the universe of the Goons, both collectively and individually, and also broaden things out to look at comedy of a certain kidney and the people who made it. So pretty much anything which makes me and my guests laugh, and very occasionally stuff with Hilda Baker in as well. Hilda Baker creeps into this podcast quite a bit, John.
Right.
John, sorry, my guest this week, I should bring him in formally. My guest this week is a comedy writer, playwright, screenwriter, novelist, script editor, John Cantor.
Hello.
Did I cover everything with that list?
Yes, screenwriter is maybe an overstatement, though I did write Full Monty 2, the sequel,
I know.
Which never, ever got made because a new head of the studio said it didn't want a follow-up to the Full Monty. But if there's a new head of studio, maybe they will, and I'll dust it down because it was, you know, probably handwritten on paper in Quink. It was that long ago. So
hang on.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there a Full Monty 2 recently on Netflix?
Yes, I'm afraid so. Damn, you noticed. Yes, that wasn't anything to do with me, I must say.
Right.
I think it was a Netflix TV series or anyway, it was an expanded version. And you've seen it?
No.
No.
I've not even seen the first one.
You haven't seen the original?
No.
Oh,
that's not my sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, listen, I know you're meant to be interviewing me, but what is it about the Full Monty that puts you off seeing it?
Right. Do you know what it is? And it's not the fact that it's men stripping at all.
Right.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, tell me.
Do you remember all the hoo-ha, all the publicity surrounding it when it came out in whatever, 97, was it?
97, exactly right, yeah.
And then our present king was filmed doing a parody of them in the gyro line. Do you remember that?
Was that for presumably for a comic relief thing? Or
I don't know, but I can't remember. But he was there,
right?
And he'd obviously expressed an interest in the Full Monty, and someone, one of his equerries or someone, you know, who hopefully got fired soon after, suggested that he and his flunkies might like to recreate that scene of them doing sort of like a hip swinging dance while they're waiting unemployment benefit.
This is exquisitely painful, but it brings us onto a very big subject. I don't know whether we want to talk about it at all,
but
that's the way that comedy is an instrument for people in political life
Margaret Thatcher in the Yes Minister sketch.
I might have to vote for her retrospectively. What? I didn't know about this. What? Tell me more.
Because she famously didn't have a sense of humour.
No.
She was proud of the fact, I think, wasn't she?
I think so. It was a guarantee of seriousness. Those are
But she did enjoy Yes Minister or Yes Prime Minister or both. And she probably didn't get the joke. But anyway, but there was some... people listening to this will know much more than me, but from memory, what happened was she was asked, or she asked if she could appear in a short sketch with Nigel Hawthorne and Paul Eddington.
Right.
As their characters in Yes Prime Minister or Yes Minister. And they agreed, and I haven't seen the footage, but I gather it's excruciatingly bad.
Yes, it's all very simple. I want you to abolish economists.
Abolish economists, Prime Minister?
Yes, abolish economists, and quickly.
All of them, Brandon.
Yes, all of them. I look forward to receiving your plan for abolition soon. Tomorrow, shall we say? Yes. I'd like you to announce it before it all leaks.
Yes, it's tomorrow. Tomorrow, Prime Minister, yes.
Yes, well, just sort it out.
That's so interesting because a recent Prime Minister, I'm not going to name him because every time you say his name, you increase his earning potential. But anyway, this recent Prime Minister was, of course, essentially, and I know what I'm talking about here, essentially a comedy writer. And when he was Foreign Secretary, he went on a diplomatic mission to the Yemen. And some diplomats who were talking to him were amazed that he said the following thing. He said, and I quote, "With friends like these, who needs Yemenis?" Now, I know, because I'm a comedy writer, that he flew all that way to the Yemen for the diplomatic mission, knowing that the one thing he had to do was say that gag, you know? So it was a comedic mission rather than a diplomatic mission. And here am I, you know, 6 years on, broadcast to the world, or such members of the world as are listening to the pod. And I just think that that's extraordinary.
Do you think that's why he accepted the gig, Foreign Secretary? He thought, hey, I've got my Yemeni joke. One day I could use that.
Wow, that's advanced comedy writing. But yes, I do. I know what it's like to have a line you want to say. And I'm gonna go off on a tangent, but it's not a tangent. I use one of my main claim to fame, and I know whatever I write, I can never beat this, is I was Douglas Adams' flatmate for a couple of years when he was writing Hitchhiker's Guide. And one of the things about Douglas was he had a telephone habit and he had a writing habit, and he combined the two by ringing all his friends, of whom there were many, from the flat on the landline. Obviously, I shared the expense of that. The day after, say, he'd been to a gig by, I don't know, Elvis Costello, he had a funny Elvis Costello gag. Watching Elvis Costello is like blah, 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 blah. So he would ring all his friends the following day and say, how are you, Jerry? How are you, Anita? How are you, Mark? But I knew that as soon as he could, he would get to the Elvis Costello gig joke. So I would hear it maybe 10 or 12 times. And I don't want to sound bitter, but I do want to sound tired of that particular gag.
Oh, did he use the same gag and just...
gigs? Douglas was... He was a very talented writer, so he would have honed that gag to within an inch of its life. So it didn't need adapting, adopting or improving. It just needed repeating.
I want to talk a bit about Douglas Adams later.
Yes, do.
But while we're on that...
Right.
I'll bring this up now.
Yeah.
Because you came up with the line, life, don't talk to me about life.
It did, it's true, yes.
Which is Marvin the Android, Marvin the
That's
Paranoid
exactly
Android.
Marvin the Paranoid Android.
Okay, now the reason I'm bringing that up now, a couple of shows ago, I played host to comedy writer Andrew Marshall.
Oh, yes.
And Andrew Marshall had been a friend of Douglas. And
certainly.
So the story goes, he was the inspiration for Marvin the Paranoid Android.
I didn't know that. I'd always thought it was David Renwick rather than Andrew Marshall. How interesting.
Oh, well, apparently, originally, Douglas had called him Marshall, the Paranoid Android.
Oh, great. Well, there you are. There you are.
But Andrew Marshall was a little bit, not hurt by it, but he was a little bit, to this day, he's a bit bewildered by why he was the inspiration, because he said, I'm not a morose man.
No, that's so interesting. Whereas David Renwick is proudly, sparing his presence, sparing his absence, proudly. Well, I would say morose. He's a melancholic man, as many comedy writers are. That is intriguing.
He's been on this as well. He was quite upbeat on this. Yeah.
Oh, I hope you. Yeah, that's so. What a little curio, right?
Yeah. While we're on previous guests, yeah. I just want, if you don't mind, John, I just want to mention something about a couple of weeks ago on this show, I interviewed Katie Seacom.
Oh, right.
Who was the daughter of the late Harry.
Right. Seacom,
okay. And you know, it was a great conversation we had, and I thought, oh, this will go down well with the massive, as I call them.
It has gone down. Massive.
Yeah, it has gone down. It has gone down phenomenally well. And I can't say that word properly. But it's the second most downloaded episode in a 24-hour period ever in the history of this podcast. We had so many people on social media responding, and so much lovely feedback and people's memories of Harry, and it just sparked off a lot of really nice, you know, the times that we're living in at the moment, lots of nice memories and reminiscences of how nice a man Harry Seacom was. Now, I only mentioned that because there was one thing that I did find out after I spoke to Katie, and it's too late to ask her. And I'm kicking myself because what I didn't realise until the other day was that her godfather was the actor Stanley Baker.
Oh, right. Stanley Baker, yes. Fine actor. Very good actor.
A great actor. One of my favourites. And in fact, I mentioned him, or we mentioned him last week on the show. We discussed a Peter Sellers film, and for various reasons, Stanley Baker came up twice in the conversation talking about a couple of his films. And as I say, when I was told that Stanley was Katie's godfather, I thought that's eyewash. You know, I thought that's rubbish. Hmm. But I did check with her, and she said, yes, I am. So Harry and Stanley were very good friends. Obviously, both Welsh entertainers in their own way.
Yes.
They liked to play cricket. They played cricket together in their younger
days. What did Harry do? I see Stanley Baker as a fast bowler. But yeah. I don't know about Seacom. I know this is might sound like a physical thing, but I see him as a wicketkeeper. Do you know? What he did?
I don't know much about cricket. Is the wicketkeeper the guy that stands behind and doesn't do much?
Look, you're from New Zealand. You grew up with this stuff, I'm sure. Hey, listen. Why don't you get Katie Seacom back for a part two? But, you know, like Graham Norton does with say Miriam Margolyes. He has her on almost every week. Because...
Oh, I'd have her on. I'd have her on. Oh, Miriam, man. Jesus. I'd have to explicit rating for this podcast.
I want to tell a quick Miriam Margolyes story.
Yes, please.
In the 80s, Miriam, I think, was at her absolute height as a voiceover artist. And I think she had set more than two houses just from voiceover fees. Anyway, I was at that time, along with everything else, because I'm a freelance writer and I have a broad repertoire of things, I was producing radio commercials at a place in Soho called Silk Sound. And I was, you know, I was earnest and I tried to be polite. And Miriam came in. I'd never met her before. And I said, "Hello, Miriam, I'm John. Here's your script for today's session." And she looked at me and said, "Ooh, what Cambridge College were you at?" Now, obviously you can't see me, but I still wonder whether that was a compliment or an insult. Was it a deadly assault on the fact that Oxbridge males dominated the entertainment industry? Or was it just her going, "Oh, you look like you got good A-levels"? I will never know because I was so taken aback. But I didn't ask her.
Well, we know she had a bit of an issue with...
With males.
Footlights.
Male God, foot. Yeah, she bloody hates her. Yeah, please, and so on. Although she loves Craig Heidel and Michael Palin. So I think, But now we're talking about it. I'm 70 years old. I've just outed myself as two things, an old white guy and an Oxbridge guy. So there's no going back from this point. But
I've had a number of people of your
vintage. Listen, get us now before they put us in museums or shoot us. and I say that without bitterness because I think we've had a bloody good time. We're like 5,000 years of it. Anyway, I'm so old and up white and a guy, an Oxbridge guy, that I can remember when I was in the Cambridge Footlights, we would sit around us men, there's no other word for it, and say, "What can we give the girl to do?" You know, the girl, meaning the girl who was going to be in the review cast. And I feel, you know, the reason I'm saying it, it's, let's face it, it's guilt. There's no other word for it. I just feel bad that that's the way we spoke between 1972 and 1974, and maybe afterwards.
Yeah. You know,
it's a strange thing.
But you wouldn't have thought that at the time. No, you didn't consciously think, oh.
No, absolutely not.
You know, we're being...
And indeed, they Radio 4 Extra kindly repeated a sketch show I was in 1974 called, I think it was called Oh No, It Isn't. Along with Griffith Jones and John Lloyd and various other luminaries.
Mm.
And I thought, my God, I hope they get rid of those sketches in which we do Pakistani accents. Because, of course, that's just what we did. Because everybody did.
Well, don't come on this podcast talking about people doing Indian accents. Pakistani accents.
Welsh Pakistani accents.
Well, Sellers and Milligan.
Oh, dear.
Okay. I just mentioned, and we'll start. I want to talk to you about, because obviously this is a podcast that's ostensibly about the Goons, and we're going to talk about that and your whatever sort of history or inspiration you have derived from them. By the way, Miriam, the offer is open. I'd love to have a bit of you on. Because she's getting involved with, I noticed Jane Milligan, who I'm in contact with and guest of the show, who's Spike's daughter. She posted something on Twitter, still Twitter, not X, Twitter, about a new, it looked like an animated version of Spike's Bad Jelly the Witch story. Don't know if you're aware of Bad Jelly the Witch.
No, I don't know. No, I admit.
But, but there looks to be some new version coming out, and Miriam Margolyes is going to be part of the voice cast, it would appear. So that's very exciting. So, perfect excuse for Miriam to come on if you
absolutely
would like to.
But
I mentioned, obviously, she let's face it, she's got a bit of a potty mouth.
That's that's her she's her filter is just, it's down the plug hole. The glory of Miriam is she never ever had a filter, so she never had one to lose.
So I went to the head of the Footlights Club and said, I haven't had an invitation. And he said, it's an oversight. I said, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to watch myself.
You're doing really well.
It's such a shame, because we love it when you just let rip.
I know, but it upsets some people, and I don't want to upset people, because the whole thing is, life is shit at the moment. It really is. It's terrible.
Sorry.
And we've...
No. I know.
So obviously, thank you very much for coming on. Now, you've written extensively. You've gone on record to say that you're happy. How do I put this? Happy not to be in the limelight yourself, but you surround yourself with comedy performers who interpret your work, and you don't have a sort of a desire to be front and center. And you're much happier writing.
I don't have a desire to be front and center, but damn, when I am, I enjoy it.
So, oh right. Okay.
it goes both ways. But a friend of mine once said, you're a sort of comedy butler. And, I'll take that. I have served the great. And I've worked with some of the greats. I've worked with some of the smalls. And I've worked with some of the mediums, I've got to say. And, it's been interesting from that point of view. Always, you have a voice in your head when you start to write. And that, I think, for any writer, look, let's be straightforward about it. If you're asked, if Lenny Henry, for example, says, you're going to write my next stage show with me, my next touring show, you have two great advantages. You have Lenny's voice in your head, and you have a guaranteed audience, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a glorious thing, given how often a freelance writer will, as it were, write blind, not knowing if anybody's going to care, not knowing if any producer's going to take it up. So that's one of the best aspects of writing for well-known people, I must say.
Yeah, and you've written extensively for Lenny, I gather, over the years. But you've contributed to things like Not the 9 o'clock News, Who Dares Wins, Les Smith and Jones. Big fan of Les Smith and Jones and Smith and Jones in general. Also you were script editor on one of my all-time favourites, A Bit of Fry and Laurie.
Oh, man, I mean, what is the easiest job you've ever had? I mean, the boys, as we call them, the boys, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, wrote, I think for the first series I worked on, they wrote 173 scripts, you know, together, collectively, as it were. And my job was to read them, obviously, pick my favourites and work on those which I thought needed improvement. And the extraordinary thing about that job was every time I thought a script needed improvement, we'd work on it, improve it, and then it wouldn't make the final cut. Because the boys were just so naturally adroit at writing material.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, this is your money. This is taxpayers' money. Really, I was just being paid to read those scripts and pick my favourites. Because if you had to work on it, generally speaking, it wasn't right. It just wasn't working. But their hit rate was phenomenal. And they were also fascinating people to work with, because, and I think this is an interesting thing to explore with the Goons and indeed with any comedy collective. You had one who was very positive and sure of himself, and the other who was an agonizer. Do you want to guess which was which?
The agonizer was, of Fry and Laurie?
Yeah.
My instinct would be to say the agonizer was Stephen Fry, but
that is so interesting because you are. It's a 1-in-2 shot there, Tyler.
Yeah,
you had a 50% chance and you blew it because it was Hugh. In fact,
right,
he was desperately anxious about everything. He was a phenomenal worrier, and Stephen just sort of knew it would be okay. And similarly with Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones. Griff won't mind my saying, because I've known him a very long time, he was feverish with anxiety. I'll tell you a quick story about that. You know, I mean, when you do a TV show, you rehearse all week for it, and then on the Friday, you record it. Now, when you rehearse it, of course, the scripts go through myriad changes. So there's a famous story about Griff and Mel about to go in front of the cameras on the Friday night, the audience is about to come in, and Griff suddenly says, Jeffrey Perkins, he's talking to, was a brilliant, much missed producer of the show. So, yeah. Jeffrey, what happened to the line about the pineapple? And Griff was referring to a line in a, let's say it's a dentist sketch, because, you know, 97% of sketches in the 70s and 80s were set in dentists' waiting room. What happened to the pineapple line? And Jeffrey said, Griff, if you remember, we took that line out on draft 11. We put it back in draft 12, then we decided against it. So this version, which you're about to do in front of the audience, is draft 13. So that's where the pineapple line is gone. It's gone forever. Now, the only point in the story is that Griff is about to go in front of the cameras, in front of the people, with all these drafts fizzing, all feverishly fizzing in his mind, you know, like a sort of brain overdose. Whereas Mel Smith has not been there for all these changes to the scripts. He's not been part of that process. He comes in, he's relaxed, and he just does the lines. And he does it with, I suppose, I don't want to say he doesn't care, that would be quite wrong, but he has a natural relaxation about him, which made him wonderful to write for, incidentally. And he realized that he'd be fine. You see, he said, not unlike Stephen. He knew he'd be fine in front of the cameras. He had a natural gift.
He had a very naturalistic style of acting.
That's the reason why he was ever cast in Not the 9 o'clock News. I remember John Lloyd saying, not to me, I think to the world, before that, if you had a sketch set in a record shop, the guy playing, because it tended to be a guy, playing the man behind the counter would sort of put on a voice to say, hello, would you like to get, you know, John Lloyd said the great thing about Mel was he'd just say, right, I'm playing a guy who works in a record shop. I'll just be a guy who works in a record shop and I'll anchor it in reality. And as a consequence, he was an absolute natural.
Yeah.
Say the famous Gerald sketch.
Yeah.
He's playing the anthropologist. You watch that and you think, this is delightful, just how real this is. And how, he's a natural comedy under player, you know,
the home videos, the homemade video strand of sketches that they used to do, when I don't know if you remember those, but I don't know, third, fourth series of Elizabeth and Jones, there would always be there was a recurring gag of this dysfunctional family of which Griff was the father. And there was a mother, and there was this teenage son who played by Nigel Harmon, who went on to play Dirty Den's son in EastEnders.
You know all bodies are buried, don't you? This is great.
Yeah, but it was a dysfunctional family, terrible family, just terrible, you know, awful family. But you had also Mel playing Len the Lodger.
Right.
And it was just a slob. It just a slob. And he was so... The insouciance, I think that's the only word I can use.
The insouciance, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I just want to point out, for any lady listeners who didn't know him, that his reputation as a slob was overstated, by which I mean he was a very attractive man, had a lovely voice and a lovely relaxed way of being in the room and looking at people as they spoke. So I think he's been unfairly maligned as a sort of, you know.
Yeah, but he was happy enough. He was happy enough to play on that stereotype, wasn't he, of the wino.
Clive, this is Roger.
Hello, Roger. Come on in. Have a seat, why don't you? Help yourself to a drink. I expect you know where it is.
I beg your pardon.
You smooth bastard!
Because Griff was on the show many, many months ago, and he didn't tell me the pineapple story, but no, he told me similar ones. Where, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, but did he?
He's there. He was quite open about the fact that he was very anal and very across everything.
Yes, that's right.
And then Mel had been out, I don't know, maybe at the bookmakers, and he'd turn up and hit every mark, basically.
Yes, absolutely. He just, at whatever state he was in, he could deliver those.
Well, it reminded me of the story they say about Laurel and Hardy, where Stan Laurel was in charge of overseeing the scripts and the production, and he'd be checking the stage, the scenery, he'd be, before filming, he'd be there like hours before making sure that everything was set up. And then Oliver Hardy would turn up having been on the golf course. And he'd just turn up at the last minute and do his bit. And then
it's amazing. And you can't kind of change your nature in that way. You'd think after a while that the head of worry would go, no, I'm going to delegate some of this worry, but no. Yeah. No, it happened when you were probably a little child, that urged to control and to worry and to be anxious. And it cannot be, you can't delete it. Yeah.
No. And I want to come back to, certainly want to come back to Fry and Laurie a little bit later, if not Mel and Griff as well. But let's just talk about your early life, I suppose, your history.
Sure.
So you've openly admitted to being 70.
I have.
So you would have kind of maybe heard the last couple of series of The Goon Show on radio.
Thinking about that. Yeah. And there isn't a comedian or comedy writer of my vintage who goes on a pod or goes to a dinner party or even chats to someone in the co-op without saying what they listen to under the bedclothes as their first kind of excavation for comedy gold. And with me, it was, I'm sorry, I'll read that again. I was born in 1953, so that would have been, I think, early 60s, maybe 1962,
63. 63,
so I'm
64,
just kind of post-Goons.
Yeah.
But I hope it's okay to talk about it now we're on the subject of the Goons. But my absolute favourite, I never met Milligan, Sellers or Seacombe, but I did go to a venue in the west of London. I think it was the Commonwealth Institute, actually, in the 70s, to see Spike Milligan reading from his children's books. And what I remember from that occasion, there must have been maybe 70 of us just sitting in a small room listening to him reading. at the end, we applauded so loudly that he said, thank you. He said, I like loving people and I like people to love me. And when I said it out loud, it sounds like the cheesiest thing that anybody could say before they broke into my way or something, but it's completely unselfconscious and completely earned, if that's the word. Do you know what I mean? We really did love the man. So I can never quite think of him without remembering that. And also my father-in-law, whom I really adored, Peter Napper, he was a head teacher and a very benevolent man. And his absolute favourite poem was nothing by Keats or Wordsworth, but it was one of Spike's. And you'll all know it, so maybe you like to say it along with me at home. Mm-hmm. There are holes in the sky where the rain gets in, but they're ever so small. That's why rain is thin.
I had to think
just
then.
Imagine that. Put you in with us at Glasto with the arms aloft, waving them side to side. No girlfriends sitting on our shoulders. I don't have a girlfriend. I just want my wife to know that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just so touching. Also, other references to Spike. My friend Rory McGrath, whom you may remember from...
I certainly do.
Yeah. Rory's a very, very Milligan-influenced writer when I first met him as a radio writer. He was very, very gifted as a kind of wordplay man. And his absolute favourite joke, again, said along with me, and maybe Tyler, you'll know where this comes from. It's definitely one of Spike's. And it goes like this. The curtains were drawn, but the furniture was real. Do you know where that's from?
It sounds Milligan-esque. I can't place
it, though. Definitely Milligan, because Rory said so. But it's so beautiful. I just love it. It's just sort of the perfect...
It's typical Milligan.
Isn't it? The shift. It's the fewest words and the most effect. I absolutely, absolutely love it. And the other thing I want to say about Spike, in retrospect, I was thinking back on the comedians that I used to watch on television in the 60s. And I'm thinking particularly... Les Dawson, Frankie Howard, Tommy Cooper. I mean, all great comedians. But I'm thinking that they're of their time for a particular reason. First of all, none of those comedians, amazingly, wrote a single children's book, which now everybody does. If you're a comedian, you write children's books. And as we know, David Williams has made an extraordinary success of it. Mm. Well, of course, Lenny's just written more than one. So Spike kind of changed the template of what a comedian might be, because the other thing that I keep thinking about when I think of Spike Milligan is his extraordinary espousal of green causes. We're talking in the 1960s, is way ahead of the curve.
Sure, yeah.
I suppose it's for good and ill. You know, we expect our comedians now to not just to be funny, but to contribute their ideas, their political ideas, that certainly their charity. They must do charity work, which is, of course, great. But I sometimes sort of get a little bit confused when I see a comedian doing charity work, because I think, well, I've met you and I know you're not. I know you're not charitable. But do you know what I mean? It's a complicated matter, isn't it? Because they're doing good for the world, and the people for whom they're doing good are not going to say, well, actually, that guy's what Miriam Margulies would call a beep, you know. What do you want? Yeah. It's difficult, isn't it? It's uncomfortable. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Spike was a pioneer in so many respects.
Yeah. Also, the other thing I think about when I think about him, and this is going to sound weird, but I don't care, is he was a very, very, he was kind of a beautiful man. And there aren't many British comedians who I think are lovely to look at for an extended period of time. I don't know whether you can think of any. Rick Mayall was...
Steve Coogan, I suppose, in his pop.
Oh, wow, that's so interesting. Steve, yes. I don't think he's a patch on Spike. I love how gay this is getting. I don't think he's a patch on him. I mean, I wouldn't kick him out of bed, but then I wouldn't invite him into bed and he wouldn't be interested. And that would be a disaster because neither of us would be interested.
There'd just be an embarrassing silence, wouldn't there?
It would be terrible. How do we get here? How do we get to this bedroom, Steve? I don't even know you, man. Yeah, but I do think, yes, Rick.
Yes.
Rick and Spike had a kind of a real, they're really wonderful looking people. And it occurs to me, I went to the Edinburgh Festival last year, and I'm not talking about beauty now, but I'm talking about something else. If you go and see a stand-up comic, you're there for an hour, and I'll probably get cancelled for saying this, but it actually matters quite a lot what they look like, because you know that's what you're going to have to look at for the next hour. You're going to have to look at their faces, so you must be drawn, you know, you must be happy to watch that face for an hour.
Yeah, I know what you say. I mean, Spike, people listening to this might be scratching their head saying, well, that white-haired, bearded man used to wear Hitler moustache in the Q series was... Yeah. But Spike in his youth, or certainly during the war and into the early days of the Goon Show, he was like matinee idol.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I think women loved him. And putting on my Miriam Margolyes hat, that's a terrible image, Miriam Margolyes hat. One of the things things extraordinary, just about times being different. I saw Spike on a talk show, I can't remember what it was, and he was asked about his first wife. And I think the question was, tell us about your first wife. And he said, well, I married my first wife because I wanted to see her breasts. And I thought, what an extraordinary thing to say. Firstly, because it's true. And secondly, how lucky are we of later generations that we can see people's breasts without marrying them? You know, that's saved a lot of human misery, I put it to you.
He said variations of that over the years.
Oh, good. I'm glad it wasn't just a sort of bizarre one-off. Yeah.
Spike was definitely a boob man. We know that.
You don't have to choose, Spike.
No, I'm sure he was interviewed by Dr. Anthony Clare.
Oh, yes, I love that show.
In the psychiatrist's chair many, many years ago, obviously, the early 80s or mid 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he said on that something about,
I think that's where I got it from, yeah.
Yeah, I married my first wife because she had big boobs and I didn't, or something like that. Something like
yeah,
that.
You have to make a joke out of it, Spike. We can see through that. We know you're using humour to distance us from the truth.
You got married around this time?
Yes, I did. Actually, I was mad. The girl proposed to me. She said, will you marry me? And I thought, I didn't want to disappoint her, so I said yes.
Had you known her long?
Oh, I'd known her about a year. I think it was physical love, though. She had big boobs, and I didn't.
Can I just say one final Spike thing, which I use to this day? I don't know how people are on the Q series. I mean, the BBC, as far as I know, you'll know better, Tyler. I don't think they've repeated them, have they?
Yeah, that it has. BBC Four did like a clip show or a compilation, I mean, we've covered it recently on this show. We, two parts episode. We talked about myself and a guest watched 5 episodes of Q. Didn't watch it all, but it is available. All of it, or most of it's available on DVD.
How did it hold up?
A bit like Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Oh, right.
A big chunk of it doesn't hold up.
There's a lot of dross in there.
Yeah, I'm not just talking... I mean, there's quite a bit of blackface and stuff like that.
Yeah, there. Sure.
But there's also just stuff that just goes on too long. But, you know, as I think I said at the time, I think in amongst the dreck, there's a lot of beauty. And there's some great, great sketches. There's some hilarious stuff in Q.
Yes,
You were going to say something about Q.
No, it's only there's just a single line that I've remembered from about 1969. I still use it to this day. The doorbell rings. Spike goes to the door, opens the door, welcomes the guests into his hall and says, excuse the mess. We've got the Conservatives in. That's it, isn't it? Just try it. Ladies and gentlemen, try it. You may not have more than a year to use that gag, but it is a beautiful gag. I don't know whether you've talked on the pod about Son of Oblomov. You know that about
I
that?
Do know of. We haven't talked about it, though, no.
Ah, well, I saw it. It ran in the late 60s at the what's now called the Harold Pinter Theatre, but was then called the Comedy Theatre.
Yeah.
which was a stage version of the Goncharov story about a man who refuses to get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great, fascinating story and kind of perfect for a comedian because obviously he's bedbound and yeah. that means all the attention is drawn to him. Anyway, the show was renamed Son of Oblomov for the simple reason that Spike either refused or couldn't stick to the script.
Yeah.
So basically it was over the course of the performances, there was maybe 15% Goncharov and 85% Spike. And it was a fantastic night out in the theatre for everyone, except, I thought, even at 16, you know, except for his fellow actors, because it's not easy being on stage with someone who could and would do anything, you know. You obviously have to go with the flow, but it was testing, you know. It was difficult for
them.
They were there to be stooges and, you know, you've got to feel for actors because that's... They're trained to inhabit a character. And they went on and, of course, they were just mercifully had the piss taken out of them.
I can't remember who were his co-stars in that.
Yes,
but
I have to look that up. I think John...
John Bluthal would usually be one of his... He surrounded himself with people who were very good at bouncing off his riffs. So John Bluthal was one. People like David Lodge, people like even Valentine Dial, would you believe?
Oh, right, yeah.
Mm. But you, because you were president of Footlights
In
the early 70s at Cambridge. Now, you know, Spike famously around, you know, in our circles, in my circles, he appeared in a two-man show at Cambridge. Performed a couple of hours worth of stories, songs, poems, jokes. He and a South African musician called Jeremy Taylor.
Yes, I've heard.
That was 73.
Well, that's when. Oh damn, I missed it. I wish I'd get in the TARDIS and go back. I was a student there. Oh damn.
Yeah, but I would have put money on the put me house on the fact you'd have been there. But
yeah, oh, I'm so disappointed.
Maybe you were off squiring or something in the.
Oh no! I want to go back to 73. I want to see Tamsin Hale again. Tamsin, I don't know what happened with us, but if you listen to this, don't get in touch because too much water has flown under too many.
50 years. 50 years.
50 years, man. Yeah.
And what about? Okay, I know you never. Obviously, you've seen Spike. You haven't met him, but you've seen him.
Yeah.
Were you a fan of the work of Peter Sellers?
Ah, that's such a good question. The answer is yes and no. Clearly, there are some astonishing achievements. And never mind the goons, I'm thinking particularly of Dr. Strangelove. I mean, one of the things I admire so much about Sellers is there are so few British, there's so little British comic talent that's been able to conquer America and the world to make movies. And let's talk about them. I mean, from the later generations, yours and mine, I can really, you take your hat off to Sacha Baron Cohen, who's made movies that have been global. I also take my hat off to Steve Coogan, who's had an extraordinary film career, and to Armando Iannucci for doing Death of Stalin and so on.
Mm.
And also to Edgar Wright, because I think
Simon Pegg, of course.
And Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg, absolutely. He's hanging out with Tom Cruise as we speak.
Doesn't like to talk about it, though.
Hmm?
Doesn't like to talk about it.
Oh, not even to Tom.
No. Simon Pegg famously is very reticent when it comes to talking about his friendship with Tom Cruise.
Yes.
I'm saying that with a wry smile on my face.
Yes, quite. I think future generations will probably find out why. But listen, we move on to say, that Sellers' film career has the most phenomenal heights, never mind the early British I'm All Right Jack films. To have made both Strangelove and Being There is a fantastic achievement. But then, I don't know whether you ever saw, do you know the actor Simon Williams?
I certainly do.
Yeah, fine actor. I saw him on television talking about, I think he was in one of the final Manchu.
The fiendish plot of Dr. Fu Manchu, Sellers' final film.
Yeah, I knew you'd know. Well, he was in it, and I remember seeing him talking on television about it, and he said, you know, I was in my trailer. He probably shared his trailer, actually. He said, I was in my trailer. We had a scene scheduled for the afternoon. I'm ready to go on. You know, I'm ready. And then the word comes to my trailer, you know, from the second assistant director, third assistant director. Peter can't do the scene this afternoon because his astrologer or astrologist, don't even know the word. Anyway, the person who reads, sees the stars, reads the stars, has decreed that this is not a good afternoon for Peter to do a scene. And if you think about that, just on a what I might call a humane level, and I'm speaking as one of the, you know, I'm speaking as a kind of supporting act, backroom boy. I mean, it's kind of intolerable, isn't it? And it just makes me sad to think about his greatness at the same time as having to think about stuff like that.
The tiniest things would trigger Sellers, and it could have been something as simple. It could have been that somebody was in the vicinity of the film set, you know, maybe within 5 miles, who was wearing a purple raincoat.
Ah, yes. Scene. Yeah, I just read that. Perhaps it was on X, Twitter X. Goldie Hawn talking about that very thing. Appearing first, there's a girl in my suit, mm-hmm. scene wearing a purple trouser suit.
Yeah.
Being told that it was the colour that Peter Sellers hated.
If Sellers got wind of someone wearing purple, even, you know, just one of the catering staff, that was it.
But now there's a nice twist to that story, because according to the story Goldie Hawn tells, he arrived, saw in the purple suit and said, "My God, but you look lovely," which is a quote from the script. So good on him, he covered it up. Mm. Nevertheless, it's painful to think about him in the context of stories like that, because I know actors are insecure, but you know, there might be 150 people dependent on you for doing that scene, and it's just such a shame, you know? It's sad.
I think there were little indications of him, A, being not well physically, and B, being pretty off the wall inside his head, pretty flaky. A good day was great, but a bad day was just horrible.
I shall find you, Eden.
He stopped us all. We all had to go and have a vitamin B12 injection. He said, "There's no energy in the scene. It's just not working." And we all had to go and have this wretched vitamin injection. He was as mad as a snake.
Yeah, I try to... what's the word? Divorce the man from the art, as they say.
Yes, quite. I know that's got harder in recent times, but
it has. And look, you know, we're all fans. I'm sure you are, of the Beatles, but we've heard the stories about John Lennon's behaviour sometimes. Have you had a chance to listen? Because the day that we're recording this, it's the day after Now and Then.
Now and Then, I have listened, and it did make me well up for a curious reason, actually. It made me well up when I heard the guitar and I thought, oh, that's George. And then I read that it wasn't. It was
Paul
playing in the style of George and that tone, that George tone. And of course I loved it, but it's not, I can't pretend it's not, perhaps it's the, I wish that the verbal hook was stronger, you know. I don't think Now and Then it sort of gets you like a great hook does, you know. But I know it's wonderful to hear.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very emotionally moving. I like it. I certainly prefer it to Real Love from.
Yes. Or Free.
Free as a Bird.
I actually like Free as a Bird.
That's okay. That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. While I've got you, I do want to talk about, as I say, I want to talk about some of the people, some of the work you've been involved with. As you sort of said at the beginning, you know, your friendship with Douglas Adams is well known. You lived with him for a number of years, was it just a case that he got married and you had to vacate? Was that what happened?
I lived with him in just off the Holloway Road, and then we moved to Highbury New Park, and then I think it just, you know, I'm struggling to remember. I think I'd simply moved out because I felt we'd been together, you know.
40 years.
And it didn't feel a day too long. Oh, it was so hilarious. The story I remember with such affection is one day in about, I suppose about 1981 or two, Douglas said, I'm just going to the off license to buy, just want to get a can of Coca-Cola. So I said, oh, okay, see you in a minute, you know. And he came back, he was a very big man, 6'5". And he was holding, I kid you not, 144 cans of Coke. And these, you know, these giant, giant. Yeah. And he said to me, look, I went to, he was so, he was childlike and excitable in a very endearing way sometimes. He said, look, I've just been to the off license and I realize I've made enough money now. I can buy, I don't have to buy a can of Coke. I can buy 12 dozen. And that's what he did. And ladies and gentlemen, I don't even drink Coke. So he must have drunk the horse.
It's good going, carrying, lugging that from the.
Yeah,
from
yeah. It was, an impressive sight. Almost as impressive as I went on holiday with him in 1978 to Corfu. And it's so embarrassing. But why do you feel later in life obliged to tell embarrassing stories? We used to sit outside Taverna's and play. He'd play Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer. He was a huge Paul Simon fan.
Yeah.
On the guitar, and we would sing The Boxer with me supplying, you know, 57% accurate harmonies. In the hope of, you know, meeting girls. And we didn't meet one girl. And she liked us both. And sort of by the same token, liked neither of us. But on that holiday, I saw what no one else in history has ever seen, which is I was with Douglas on a nudist beach. And I watched him coming out of the water, just clad only in snorkel and flippers. And it was, I tell you, ladies, wow. It was quite a sight.
Yeah.
I don't know what the correlation between height and male girth or male length is, but damn, it was confounding. It was one of those times when you feel glad you're not a lady, I have to say. Yeah.
Okay. Didn't you, speaking of ladies, I read something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You wrote something I read where you said that your mother used, when you were living with Douglas, your mother would often phone, but not to talk to you, or she'd talk to you, but she'd only want to find out what Douglas had been up to.
Oh, is man. Thanks for bringing that up. I love free therapy. Yeah, that was a feature. I mean, that was a feature of my mother. She was very excited when I worked with people who she could see on the telly, but it did have that corollary that she would ring up and say, hello, Jonathan, how are you? And then when I gave the answer, it's like, well, she had to listen to that, obviously, because... that was her primary duty. But then she would always say, how's Griff? You know, how's Griff? How's Douglas? And I know that when Griff's mother rang Griff up, she didn't say, Griff, how's John Cantor? Is he still talking? You know, so it did get to me, yeah. But, you know, fame is the spur. What can I say? It's intoxicating. Yeah. So even at kind of one remove.
Yeah. And you mentioned Griff.
Yeah.
So you were both in Footlights together.
We were, yeah.
Yeah. And then he, because I know he became a radio producer first.
That's right.
And then he got sort of, he was a minor part of the first series of Not the 9 o'clock News and then graduated to...
That's right. Chris Langham left and Griffin.
Yeah. Did you have the opportunity potentially to... you know, to follow that path yourself, if you know what I mean.
I've had a flashback to the Edinburgh Festival, 1973.
Hmm.
Yeah. The producer of a show called Up Sunday saw the show and asked me whether I wanted to be on it. And that's when I, said no. I didn't feel it was for me. So that's, that is a genuine opportunity that I missed.
Oh.
To be a performer. But I'm still happier to be a writer. It's odd. I got every so often I do a public appearance, like I'm interviewing. I'm introducing a series of screwball comedies at the cinema in Aldborough in Suffolk, where I live. I just do a 5-minute intro. This Sunday we've got His Girl Friday. from 1940. A great film. Mm. And my job is simply to write 5 minutes of intro, and you know, it's not a big deal, but it preys on my mind. I just, even at that age, I thought, wow. My question, it's an odd question, but it's very simple. Supposing you're doing a show in the evening, what are you meant to do in the day? And I still kind of wonder that. Just to tell you, my most recent public appearances, in 2019, Lenny Henry went on a nationwide tour to promote his first volume of autobiography. It's called Who Am I Anyway? And as his long-term cohort, he said to me, take this book and out of it, construct an hour's stand-up material. So I duly did. I mean, it was a pleasure. It was always a pleasure working with Lenny. And then he said, for the second half, I'm damned if I want to learn anything more. So you're going to come on tour with me, and the second half of the show every night is going to be you interviewing me in a kind of, you know, Michael Parkinson, Graham Norton-y kind of way.
Right.
So that's what I did. I went on a 42-day tour of the United Kingdom with Lenny Henry every night, asking the same questions. So, Lenny, I'm very interested in how you went from doing sketches and comedy to Shakespeare. That's an extraordinary leap. How did it happen? And whether you like it or not, and I didn't, that is a kind of an acting job. In other words, not only do you have to ask the question, you've got to look interested in the answer. And not only do you have to look interested in the answer, you have to look surprised by the answer, like you didn't hear it last night in Bradford and the previous night in Stoke.
Yeah.
Once we came on stage, and then he said, Jack, for some reason he always calls me Jack. Jack, you nodded too quickly. You nodded before I'd given the answer. So there you are. So
but of course, he would have to give the impression that it was the first time he'd heard the question.
Ah, exactly. So in that sense, we're equal. But you know what I did? I made sure I had 4 gags in that interview segment. So I always knew, if nothing else. And I road tested them. That's what you do. As you know, any touring comedian or touring interviewer does the same thing, which is to road test the material.
Did you ever try and throw him with, like, you know, okay, a question he wasn't prepared for, like, what's your inside leg measurement or something?
Absolutely not. No, because as I say, I'd given myself these little bonbons, the little sweets. And I remember, I'll just tell you, because it gives me pleasure if nobody else. I used to say to him, you know, Lenny, are you kind of addicted to technology? And he'd go, no, I don't, not particularly, no. And I'd go, oh, that is so untrue. Yesterday, we drove all the way from Stoke to Nottingham. That's like a, you know, it's a 90-minute journey. And I swear to God, you never took your eyes off your phone. I mean, okay, you drove safely. So that was the gag. Yeah. And it just gave me joy. You know, every night I got a good laugh. And I thought, oh, this I like this work, because I'm going to get a laugh tomorrow night in Middlesbrough on that. And that's the tiny joy of being a travelling interviewer.
Oh, brilliant. And Lenny Henry, you've obviously worked with him extensively. Yeah. And also Dawn, I believe.
Yes, I wrote Murder. Yes, I did write an episode of Murder Most Horrid for Dawn back in the 80s. It was acceptable in the 80s, as Calvin Harris memorably sang. Yeah. Yeah. Lenny told me that, and I'm sure he told the world, that he invited Dawn to see his stand-up show.
Right.
And after the show, she came back and she had 73 notes for him. Now, that's remarkable in many ways, not least because it speaks to her ability to write legibly in the dark.
Yeah.
But also, I've always loved that story because I think performers like to be... A friend of mine once said, being edited is like being loved. And I thought that's a very acute observation, because obviously a lot of what you say will be, in quotes, negative. But you can say it in such a way that you're saying, look, I believe in you, I support you, I think you could do this better. And I think that really chimed with him, you know?
Yeah. And that brings us nicely onto back to a bit of Fry and Laurie.
Yeah.
Like you say, you had the best job in the world. You were there reading these sketches, these bits, and sifting through and deciding what you felt worked, what needed work. and et cetera, et cetera. Did you actually contribute anything in terms of writing?
Do you know, I did. I contributed. My great contribution to British television comedy, I maintain, is this tiny thing. They used to do a series of spoof Vox Pops.
Maybe. Yeah, I know. Yep.
They're beautifully done. And one of them had Stephen in a sort of 1950s housewife hat.
Yes, I can picture it. Yep.
Yes, and he would just say, he would start to say something, and he'd put his hand over his mouth and go, "Oh, I think I've left the iron on." And then he'd come out of flame. And I said, and this is where I changed the face of comedy, I said, "You should just play that every week. There's no need to write another one for the character. It's nice. I mean, come on, I've listened to Help by the Beatles 710 times, and it's great every time. In fact, the pleasure is partly in knowing what's going to happen."
Yeah.
But that's what they did. And then I used to think later, well, like with the Fast Show, you know, I'm not saying they got it from me, although I kind of am.
So you kind of inspired those Vox Pop bits?
No, I didn't inspire the Vox Pops. I just thought there's... You know, the agony of creating comedy is such that why don't you have 14 seconds of the show, which is the same every week. So that'll save us 14 seconds of agony.
Because you'd often have, like you say, you'd have Stephen dressed as that 1950s lady. You'd have Hugh dressed as a policeman.
Yes, that's right.
And you'd have Stephen dressed, my favourite one of those, is Stephen dressed as this kind of, he's like wearing a tank top. His hair's slicked right back. Thick glasses.
I went round to her primary school because they had that end of term thing, and they shove all the paintings they'd done in her class, they shove them all around the wall. Oh, crap!
Oh, it's just, honestly, YouTube is the great fountain of joy in anybody's life who loves comedy. You know, just go to the YouTube and watch that stuff. And it unfailingly makes me raw. And the thing I treasured about them was, I don't think it's sentimental to say that great comedy can or does come out of friendship. You know, there's been many great, I mean, look at Dawn and Jennifer. You can't fake it, but the shared way of feeling about something. So Hugh would come in one morning to rehearsal and say, "Oh God, I can't believe it. I took my car to be serviced." And the man said, I'm busy with another car, but my colleague will be along in a minute." And Hugh would go, my colleague. And this, with a face that said, "This is the worst thing that's ever happened to a person in the world." And Stephen would understand. The rest of us were, you know, what's wrong with that? But the rest, you know, it was astonishing that kind of telepathy and shared love and hatred of stuff.
Absolutely. I think, I was trying to think of, knowing that I was going to talk to you and we were going to talk about the show, I was trying to think of if I could single out my favourite bit of Ryan Laurie's sketch, or bit, ever. And I don't know if it's one you remember particularly, but it's the Mr. Simnock sketch. Hugh playing a very old man with very long white hair in a brown dressing gown, and Stephen's playing his carer, for want of a better word. Do you know that one?
No, I don't. I'm excited to know what's going to happen.
And Stephen's playing a very effeminate character. It's a very funny sketch in general. Him wanting his cocoa, Stephen sort of fussing around him. And then the crux of the sketch is Mr. Simnock wistfully rueing the fact that he's not done so many things in his life that he wished he'd done.
Right.
So, such as watching a woman urinate, riding a camel, I think. And there was a few others. It wasn't just the lines and the comedy. It was the character that Hugh played. It was perfect. And the character that Stephen played was perfect. And I will take that sketch to my grave.
"I want to drink milk from the breasts of a Burmese maiden."
"I don't know what's got into you today, Mr. Simnock. I don't really. I think we're going to have to give you some extra vitamin E. Burmese maidens in Todmorden.
You've got bad breath, you have.
Well, there's no call to be getting personal, I hope.
Like rotting cabbages.
I'm very angry with you today, Mr. Simnock.
You're a great Nancy.
I'm not a great Nancy, Mr. Simnock, and you're wicked to say so.
You're a great Mary Ann Bumboyne Nancy, but you've never even done it.
I'm not going to take any more of this from you, Mr. Simnock. I'm not really.
You shouldn't be in a place like this at your time of life.
Well, someone's got to do it. Dedication. The why I bother, I do not know.
You should be out there having oral sex and killing people and watching women urinate in opera houses and eating hamburgers in opera houses and drinking milk from the breasts of Nepalese maidens.
It was Burmese last time.
Well, Nepalese, I've changed my mind. Instead, you're stuck here taking rude talk from an old man. You're a great bog-breathed Nancy.
You've really upset me today, Mr. Simnock. You have, really. Now, I'm going out to hurry along your cocoa. When I get back, I don't want any more nonsense. Honestly.
You're a screaming great Bertie in your pong. 92 years old, and I've never watched a woman urinate. Tragic waste, that.
Oh, man. And I want to congratulate you on, in your introduction, using the phrase wistfully ruined, which is a delightful phrase.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
something that they, and I mean this in the nice as possible, something that either of them could have said with
yes.
incredibly gifted their advanced education. Because English was definitely there.
Oh, there's so many sketches. Yeah. So many sketches, like the language sketch where he talks about language.
Yes, I mean, they were... I mean, people talk about undergraduate humour, but I think they graduated. I think they were glorious, available to all. And I just remembered, I want to bring it back to Spike. I just remembered a Hugh Laurie joke that I think Spike could have written. He just is playing himself, effectively. He holds up, I think it was a pair of socks. It might have been a pair of pants. Let's say it was a pair of underpants. He holds up a pair of underpants to the camera and he says, you know, there's a funny story attached to these underpants, but I'm afraid it's fallen off. Yeah, I think Spike would have been proud of that. I think it's
yeah
it's lovely. Once again, it's wonderfully visual.
Absolutely. There's a few other people that you've worked with I
want
to just touch on that I admire.
Yeah.
And again, circling back to Douglas Adams, you and John Lloyd collaborated on Afterlife.
Yes. On Afterlife, yeah. Yes.
Which was basically what the follow up to John Lloyd and John and Douglas's Meaning of Life.
That's absolutely right. Yes. Douglas and John's friendship was incredibly strong. I think John thinks about him every day of his life, actually. So I was kind of very glad to be invited onto that small team to take that format and revisit it. And it was a joy. It was very, very interesting to me, though, because we went to, in typical, blimey, this is so Douglas Adams. And Douglas Adams, what he used to do was hire a villa in, Tuscany, even Australia. I was in Sydney one time and he hired a villa to write, which is just, in a way good and in a way completely daft, because writing, it is an introvert activity. There's frankly, you might as well be looking out on the Holloway Road as looking out on Tuscan mountains, because do you know what I mean? You're not really going to partake of them.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway,
it doesn't make sense. Yes.
Doesn't really make a lot of sense, but. And the whole joy of going away, I think, is getting away from what you do all day. But anyway, so John and I naturally hired a villa in a villa. We hired a little house in Foy in Cornwall, you know, near sort of Daphne du Maurier country.
Yeah.
And first day co-writing, we sat opposite each other. And you could tell, what do we do now? In other words, do we properly co-write and offer up things for the other person to comment on and then rewrite? And the answer was no. We sat within a few inches of each other, like you did in the fifth form when you kind of hid your work from the person at the next desk because he didn't want he didn't want to have it seen or nicked. Do your own geography O-level homework. So it was the most odd thing. But then, of course, we read them out and it was fine. But I'm always very interested in how writing partnerships work. And ours didn't, really. But it was fine. Normally, there's a person who sits at the laptop and somebody who wanders around.
So, if for example, so you were sat there together.
Yeah.
And you were coming up with definitions.
Yes.
Basically. So, like, I'm just thinking, so, you know, the frustration that you feel when you can't get the cellophane off a CD or a DVD, that sense of frustration.
Absolutely.
Would you have said, tried to think of a word for that? For example?
Ah, that's interesting. No, that's a good question. And no, we would rather, certainly I would rather be there with the gazetteer or the Google Maps and go, foy, Teddington.
Yeah.
Folk okay. News. You know, yeah, look for the inspiration in the word rather than work backwards from the meaning. Yeah.
Got you. Okay. Okay. So you'd find the location and then you'd spend an hour thinking of the definition.
Yeah. Preferably a minute, but possibly an hour. Yes. Okay. Yes.
And you've recently or relatively recently been involved. You write a lot for radio.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what it's called. I'm so sorry. Believe It.
Believe It with Richard Wilson. Yeah, I wrote six series of that for Richard.
Has that finished now?
Yes, it has.
Right.
Age has got to us, Tyler, particularly. Mm. Yeah. So we did 24 and it was great, but
Now, I'm a huge Richard Wilson fan. I was before One Foot in the Grave, even.
Oh, then no, that's good. That marks you out. If you were...
Well, I enjoyed him very much. I was a big fan of Only When I Laugh.
Oh, right, yes.
With the perpetually ill, or at least hospital-bound, James Bolam and Peter Bowles Christopher Strowley. And, of course, Richard Wilson was one of the... was like the head doctor that would always, look through his half-moon spectacles at the disapprovingly.
with that withering glare.
Withering glare, yes. Yeah. But now I'm One Foot in the Grave is certainly one of my favorite sitcoms. And what was it like working with Richard?
Well, it's very interesting. It was meant to be sort of pseudo autobiographical.
Yeah.
But actually, he said to me earlier, "No, you do it, John. You write it. I'll be fine with that." So he's a very private man, but he sort of rather liked. I would kind of tease him in a way, and I take as much as I could from what I knew of his real life. So I knew, say, of his friendship with Ian McKellen. And I thought, we've got to have as much Ian McKellen as we can. So I created a character for Ian McKellen. We called him Head of Gay. And that was rather, that was the kind of thing I think he enjoyed because, he wasn't a sort of, as you probably know, he didn't come out till the 90s, actually. And so he wasn't a great... public figure in that way, but he liked the fact that that I went for that. And the other thing to say about Richard is, and Sean Ed William, who was running Radio Light Entertainment, made the point. Goodness, he was such a natural for radio. Nobody sounds like Richard. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Mm.
And of course, when he went to drama school in the early 60s in London, they sort of thought, well, you'll never work in this town again with an accent like that. But it used to be hilarious if Richard, you can't ask Richard, don't ask Richard to do an accent, because that's an absolute waste of his extraordinary talent for being himself. And the other thing I loved, let's face it, he's very, very popular he's done a lot of work in theatre. People love him. So, if you want to get David Tennant to do Richard Wilson's radio show, of course he'll do it.
When One Foot in the Grave ended, very soon after, Richard appeared in another sitcom called Duck Patrol.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
With David Tennant, the young David Tennant, and Jason Watkins, I think.
Yes, I think that's right. Again, you can find little bits of it on YouTube.
Yeah. But no, and wonderful man. I mean, I'd love to have him on this because I know he's a fan of the Goons, but he's probably got better things to do.
What was happening?
Richard was sounding more and more like our old pal Ian McKellen playing Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. All portentous and momentous and pretentious. Anyway, he cancelled the hotel and we set off for London. And I drove and I drove. I drove through the night. At 6 in the morning, my head lolled forward onto the steering wheel. Luckily, I was parked outside Richard's flat at the time.
David?
Ah, what?
You fell asleep.
Oh, blimey. Right. I'll say goodbye and head home. Thank you so much for everything. It was memorable. Wouldn't have missed it.
I'm glad.
But let's not do it again soon.
Listen, you can't drive home in your condition. Come up and have a cup of coffee. Strong enough?
Absolutely. I'm buzzing.
Good. I want you to listen closely. In my will, I'm going to leave you my walking stick and my mobile.
In your will, you've left me your walking stick and your mobile.
You don't have to repeat what I say. Just listen.
Sorry, I'm so wired. I'm feeling incredibly awake and totally zonked at the same time.
Okay, well, before we wrap up, I know that you've written plays, you've written novels. Yeah. What are you working on at the moment?
What I'm working on now is I had a play on in Edinburgh in 2022.
Yeah.
And being a play at Edinburgh, it only lasted an hour. And I've extended it into a full-length piece. It's called 500 Couples, and it's about a couples counsellor, a woman who's hit her 60s and has basically been saying the same things for 32 years in her job and has got to the end. So it's a kind of, I've called it a rom-com. It's basically about the central character is a couples counsellor who, as I say, has been doing the job for 32 years and in fact does not have a partner herself. So
okay.
We see her getting to the end of her professional career and then we see whether she's going to have a man in her life. So I've got a read through of that this week. And also I wrote a novel called A Short Gentleman about a barrister who commits a crime but cannot admit that he's done anything wrong. And that's incredibly close to my heart because I studied law and my father was a solicitor. And there is something about a highly educated person who can't admit they've done anything wrong, which really appeals to me. So I've done a one-man show based on it, and that's got a read-through in January. So basically what I'm doing now is trying to get back on stage. You know, I really miss working with Lenny Henry on his live show. That's come to an end, but I just loved being all over the place in front of an audience. Working on the show, you know, making it better, going back into the dressing room and saying that bit didn't work. I love the whole process.
There's bound to be more Lenny Henry shows.
I don't think so. I think Len now has probably hung up his stand-up suit. Because the most recent stage work he did was a play called August in England, which is a one-man show. It's a one-man play, which he wrote and put on at the Bush Theatre. It was excellent. And I think, I think he's, it's so interesting. And I don't say this with any kind of attitude, but when I met Lenny in 1990 or something, you know, this is a guy who'd left school at 15 or 16 and gone to work in a foundry. Since which time, because he's such an incredible, got such an incredible appetite for everything. He's got a PhD, he's got an MA, you know, and he's far outstripped me in terms of education. So in the beginning, I think he, 32 years ago, I don't think he had the confidence to be a writer, but he's got that now.
Yeah. You know,
he's got a drama series on ITV as we speak, Three Little Birds.
Yeah.
You know, I think he's found himself.
And, sometimes it can take 30 years to reach that.
Yeah.
Okay. And John, it has been genuinely huge amount of fun speaking to you because you're very, you know, you've got a wealth of stuff to talk about, such a career and such enthusiasm that comes through as well. It's infectious. So thank you very much for coming on. And
I've only told you the stories that are broadcastable.
You can tell me the other ones.
surely with a half a pint of Stella inside me.
Yes. Oh, John, Listen, thank you very much. It's been great.
Pleasure.
Language is the creak on a stair. It's a spluttering match held to a frosted pane. It's a half-remembered childhood birthday party. It's the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking nappy. The hulk of a charred panzer. The underside of a granite boulder. The first downy growth on the upper lip of a Mediterranean girl. It's cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot. No, no.